You may recall the film in which Monty Woolley played the man who came to dinner, who stayed on and on and on. Elijah is a man we invite to dinner on Seder night, but who never attends. We open the door for him, we have a place for him, but he's not on our front doorstep. He does not sit down at our table. Why then do we invite Elijah after these centuries of frustration? In rabbinic Judaism, Elijah is the herald of the Messiah. It is perfectly natural that as we celebrate the festival of the first deliverance from pharaonic Egypt, a Jew should look forward to the ultimate deliverance from the burden of our harsh and confusing existence. Elijah has always been an exceptional and omnipresent figure in our tradition. The first cluster of stories about him appear in the first book of Kings. In later folk tradition, Elijah comes close to becoming Judaism's guardian angel, part Merlin, part good witch in the north. He's a protector of the pious. He is a deliverer of the poor. He is the herald of the Messiah. To those who are confronted with overwhelming tragedy, he appears as if out of nowhere and turns their fate around. So we have a story of an Elijah as a Roman senator who stands up to Caesar to defend a Judean scholar who is being tried for disloyalty. We have Elijah as an Arab physician who dismounts from his horse along a country road to bring relief to a Jewish peasant in terrible pain. We have an Elijah as a Polish peasant who works side by side with a Jewish innkeeper who has been ordered to cut and tie so many bundles of wood under penalty of death. Elijah appears in the folk literature in many guises and performs many acts of unexpected deliverance. The guardian angel of the Jewish people is also a teacher, a Merlin who is also a Melamed. It's reported that Elijah delighted to discuss the intricacies of Talmudic law with Talmudic scholars. A certain pious scholar, by the name of Anon, was a good man, a careful jurist, and a student of Elijah's. One day a neighbor brought Anon a small present worth very little, which Anon turned down because the neighbor had a case before him, and he feared that he might be swayed in judgment. That, of course, was a proper thing to do. But the neighbor pressed his gift, saying, "Take it, and recommend me to some other court, where I will have my case tried." Anon wrote a letter of recommendation for the man to a fellow jurist. And Elijah, after this point, refused to visit Anon anymore. The inconsequential gift to Anon might eventually sway his fellow jurist, and the delicate scales of justice might be unbalanced. Akiba was so great an intellectual in our tradition that we tend to forget for the first 30 years of his life, he was an illiterate peasant. He could neither read nor write. In his late 20s, he had the good fortune to fall in love with the talented and worthy daughter of a local landowner. This worthy thought so little, however, of this mismatch that when the young people were married, he disowned his daughter. Akiba and Rachel were forced to live in dismal poverty as he pursued his studies. Most of the time, the warmth of their love carried them through. But every once in a while, their love was not sufficient to warm the dismal night. And one such night, a beggar appeared at the door, Elijah. Rachel had just delivered a child, and Akiba was eager to build a cradle to shield him from the cold. Elijah helped Akiba build the child's cradle, and he provided the family with food to sustain them through this difficult period. Perhaps a classic story of Elijah as teacher was told in Eastern Europe about a certain Baruch, who seems to have been the president of the local chamber of commerce and a Polish shtetl. Baruch liked his fellow citizens. He felt himself respectable, and he respected them. He was proud of his town. One day, Baruch chanced to meet Elijah in the marketplace. partly out of innocent pride, and partly out of a not-so-innocent inquisitiveness, Baruch turned to Elijah and said, "Who of all these fine people is going to merit a place in paradise?" To his astonishment, Elijah answered, "No one." Baruch didn't know what to say. His world was shattered. But then Elijah touched him on the shoulder and said, "See over there." And he pointed to a large, loutish-looking fellow coming out of a back alley. "That man will merit paradise." Baruch had the good sense to listen when Elijah spoke. He went to the man and said, "Sir, you have had a wonderful recommendation, but can't see anything that justifies it. Tell me about yourself." The man replied, "I'm a bailiff, a jailer. I have no claim to virtue except this. I always see to it that the paupers and the beggars are separated from the hardened criminals. The young who are brought in for their first offense are kept separate from hardened felons." Baruch pressed on, "That's good, but why don't you at least dress as a Jew? Why don't I ever see you in the synagogue?" "Oh," the man said, "that's easy to explain. If I were known as a Jew, ruffians would stop talking in front of me. I wouldn't be able to tell the rabbi when I heard of someone plotting to attack the synagogue or to steal something from a Jewish person." In this way, Baruch learned not to judge another by appearances. The same story, interestingly, was told about Elijah and Baruch and two clowns. Circus and gypsy peoples, theater people generally, were considered the riffraff of Europe. They were outside the pale. You never invited them to your home. You laughed at them occasionally, but you wanted nothing to do with them otherwise. One day Elijah said to Baruch, "No one here among your respectable citizens will warrant a place in paradise, but look you there." He pointed to two clowns made up in white face to amuse the crowd. "Why these clowns?" Baruch asked. Elijah answered, "Because they bring laughter into the bitterness of life. They help people forget pain and anguish and torment. For that reason, they deserve paradise." In our folk tradition, Elijah is part guardian angel, part magician, part good fairy, part a teacher of ethics, and part, for the collective, the herald of the coming of the Messiah. But what about the real Elijah? What about the Elijah who lived in the 9th pre-Christian century in northern Israel? What do we know about him? The answer is that we know precious little. The Bible is strangely silent about Elijah's origins. Beginning in chapter 17 of the first book of Kings, and running to the end of the book, we have the story of Elijah. The narrative tells of two strange men, loners, and the events of their lives, the prophet Elijah and his disciple, the prophet Elisha. Both men came unexpectedly upon the scene. Their early history is wrapped in mystery and legend. We know nothing about Elijah's pedigree, nothing about his parents, nothing about his background, nothing about his training. Only that one day, Elijah appears before King Ahab and announces, "The heavens are sealed. There'll be no more rain in Israel." We're not even told why God has ordained this drought and the famine that it causes. Then a second word of the Lord comes to Elijah and tells him to go into hiding by the Wadi Cherit, a riverbed to the east of the Jordan. There God tells him, "You will drink from the wadi, and I've commanded the ravens to feed you." Elijah did as he was commanded. The ravens brought him bread and meat every morning and every evening, and he drank when he needed from the river. When the wadi dried up because of the drought, God commands Elijah to travel west and north to Phoenicia. He begins to live with a Phoenician woman, a destitute widow, who befriended him and gave him what little she had for food. Elijah then performs a series of miracles for her. He saw to it that her pantry would be full through the entire period of the famine. He made a meager supply of oil sufficient for the year. When her young son died of illness, Elijah interceded with God, and the breath of life was returned to him. What can one make of these stories, of a man whom historians of his own time describe as a miracle worker rather than an ordinary human being? We can't dismiss these stories as evidence of the credulity of our ancestors, who are, after all, mostly uneducated and simple folk. Or we might argue that a religious leader, particularly a charismatic leader, must in fact be a miracle worker. The evangelist must be a faith healer. A treasury of miracle stories floated around the ancient Middle East and attached themselves to any number of faith healers. In the New Testament, they came to embellish the biography of Jesus. The gospel writers attached some of the Elijah episodes to the Jesus biography. The miracle of the fish and the loaves is identical with that of the widow's ever full pantry. Similar stories circulated about Jesus as about Elijah. He fed the poor miraculously, he healed the ill, he revived the dead. The gospel, according to Luke, suggests that early Christians thought of Jesus as a reincarnation of Elijah. Was there actually an Elijah, or was he simply a wish projection? After all, his name may be no name. Elijah, Eliyahu, two names of God combined as one, rather than the name of a person combined with the name of God. On the other side of the scale, there's a simple fact that there are men who seem to be able to do that which is miraculous. There are men who can, by laying on hands, heal the burden of illness. There are men who can look you straight in the eye and know what you are thinking. There are men who seem to have the capacity for looking at the shadows beyond and describing something of the future. Elijah must have been such a man. Stories speak about him as a compelling and charismatic person. We cannot deny him a human history simply because his biography appears to have been written by credulous folk and is filled with obvious legends. The biblical Elijah is more than a faith healer. He is the harbinger of good tidings for Israel. Havdalah, the ceremony which separates the holiness of the Sabbath from the mundane work week, concludes with a kiddush and the extinguishing of the candle in the wine which is burnt the day long. Havdalah is scheduled to occur during that brief period each Saturday known as Bein Hashmashot, between sunset and sundown, which was believed to be the most appropriate time for the coming of the Messiah. It is a custom of our people to sing during Havdalah the lovely hymn of Messianic hope, which begins, Eliyahu Hanavi, Eliyahu the prophet, Eliyahu Hatishbi, Eliyahu the Tishbite, Eliyahu HaGiladi, Eliyahu from Gilad, Eliyahu, Eliyahu, Bimhera b'yameinu yavo eleinu, may he come quickly to us in our time. Bimhera b'yameinu yavo eleinu, may he come speedily in our time. The biblical Elijah is a spokesman of God. He announces in the name of God that the heavens have been sealed, that there will be no rain. The text does not make clear the reasons this sentence was passed. Apparently, God is punishing Zion because the people have compromised with idolatry, and it is Elijah who forces them to compromise no longer. Omri, the father of Ahab, was a competent general administrator who became king of Israel. He recognized that Israel's most formidable enemy was Syria, and he tried to protect his flanks along the Jordan and along the Mediterranean coast. As part of that program, he arranged a diplomatic marriage for his eldest son and the future King Ahab with a daughter of the prestigious priest king of nearby Phoenicia, a man known as Ito Baal. Ito Baal plays a number of roles in history. He is the grandfather of Dido, the legendary queen founder of Carthage. For our purpose, he is simply the father of Jezebel, the queen who troubled Israel perhaps more than any other woman in history. Jezebel is not only a fair damsel, the daughter of a king, but also a priestess of the god Melkart. When Jezebel married Ahab and came to Samaria, she insisted that she be allowed to bring her priests with her and that they build a temple for her in Samaria to Melkart. Ahab acceded to her request. The temple was built to this Phoenician god in the sacred precincts of the temple. Jezebel was not satisfied with simply going to her temple and praying. She had a missionary streak in her. and she initiated a series of attacks on the priests and prophets of Yahweh, the Jewish God. Then Elijah suddenly appears and challenges Jezebel's 450 prophets and priests to a contest. The terms of the proposed challenge were that one bullock would be offered to Yahweh by Elijah, another to Baal by his priests. Baal's priests could evoke their deity, perform whatever rites they wished. Elijah would build his altar and offer a prayer to God. And when the fire came down to heaven, they would know whose sacrifice had been accepted. The Bible goes on at some length in telling the story of the building of these two altars on Mount Carmel above Haifa. The priests of Baal danced about in a frenzy. They cut their wrists so that their blood flowed on their altar. They appealed to their God to bring the heavenly fire down to light the pyre. They worked at it all day long, but their prayers were not answered. No fire came. Towards evening, it was Elijah's turn. He built his altar and said a simple prayer, and the fire came down from heaven. God had accepted his activities and his prayers. It's a legendary story, but an important symbolic one. Within it is the challenge brought to Israel by each and every prophet. How long will you crouch between two opinions? If God be God, follow him. If Baal be God, follow him. In matters of faith, there can be no compromise. Israel cannot have it both ways. Why was Israel, alone of all the peoples of antiquity, prohibited from introducing into its worship the gods of other pantheons? What was so despicable or unacceptable about heathen worship? After all, the wise men of many nations followed heathen practices. The answer is that Israel's leaders had come to a startling recognition. Where the other ancient peoples worshiped nature, the power and sparkle of natural phenomena, and the powers within nature, the moon, the sun, the stars, the storm, Israel's prophets had come to the conclusion that it was not the individual powers within nature which ought to be worshipped, but only the one creator God, the God who orders and vivifies all being. There are many powers in nature, but only one creator. He alone is to be worshipped. Today, these thoughts are commonplace, but in those times, they were revolutionary ones. It meant for the first time that all the peoples of the world could be considered as one. God becomes the basis of a concept of humanity. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us all? The concept of the oneness of God also helped in the development of science. The pagan world saw nature as a series of separate individual powers, each conforming to its own nature, each determining its own destiny, each a god. With this worldview, no science was possible. The idea that God was one, and that the cosmos a single entity, allowed natural law, for the first time, to begin to make sense. When Jezebel hears about the results of the contest on Mount Carmel, she sets out to kill Elijah. Elijah flees into the wilderness. He travels for 40 days and 40 nights. Where does he go? He goes, surprisingly, to Mount Sinai, the very place Moses had received the Ten Commandments. Elijah is the one figure in the Bible to return there, a testimony to his importance in the tradition. In Mount Sinai, Elijah has a tradition of God saying, "Get thee up to the mountain and turn to the rock." There came a great wind, and the wind burst upon the rock, but God was not in the wind. There came a great earthquake that shook the mountain, but God was not in the earthquake. There came a fire, but God was not in the fire. Then there came what the Bible calls the voice of great stillness, and Elijah knew God. He knew that God was not in the display of nature's might and power, but in the voice of great stillness, which lies behind and beyond. There is no profit in being overwhelmed by a sunset, or by the power of the sun, or by the lightning, or by thunder. These are all magnificent displays of nature's power. They all testify to the power of a single God. Yet they are not God. God is behind and beyond. The voice of great stillness, which wells up within us when we confront the daily decisions of our lives. The Bible reports that when the time came for Elijah to die, God commanded him that he go across the Jordan with his disciple Elisha. They walk along together in the wilderness. As they walked, they met groups of Israelites who said to Elisha, "Do you know that the Lord will take your master today?" Elisha responds, "He does." There's a sense of foreboding to the entire chapter. But according to the Bible, Elijah does not die, but goes to heaven in a fiery chariot. Elijah is one of only two biblical figures by which such a dramatic claim is made. This tradition explains Elijah's role in subsequent Jewish history. He is still alive. He's still available as a constant companion of Jewish life. According to the folklore, Elijah records all marriages in heaven and watches over them. He attends every bris. In Europe, there was always a chair for Elijah, placed next to the chair where the godfather sat, where he held the child for the circumcision. The chair was kept empty, so that if Elijah should come, there would be a place of honor for him. There are references to Elijah's role, messianic role, quite early in our tradition. The prophet Malachi, who lived in the 6th pre-Christian century, has this to say, "I will send the prophet Elijah to you before the coming of the awesome and fearful day of the Lord, to reconcile fathers with their sons and sons with their fathers, so that when I come, I do not strike the whole land with utter destruction." Some 3 centuries later, Joshua ben Sirach, a Jerusalem school teacher who maintained an academy for the sons of well-born Jerusalem gentlemen, composed an epic poem in which he told the history of Israel through the lives of the great men of Israel. The verse which he devoted to Elijah, he tells of the miracles which Elijah performed. He ends his verse in this way, "It is written, you, Elijah, are to come at the appointed time to allay the divine wrath before its final fury, to reconcile fathers and sons, to restore the tribes of Israel." Elijah was probably chosen for this role in the messianic drama because of the story that he did not die, and also because he was seen as such a power-laden, charismatic figure. This identification comes early in the tradition and has remained fixed ever since. It's only natural that we would want to welcome Elijah to our Passover feast. Elijah is our expected guest on Seder night because he bespeaks in his presence a message of redemption. If he should suddenly appear at our doorstep, the great messianic drama would have begun. A time of justice, freedom, and peace will have arrived for our troubled world. Haggadah is nothing more than the chronicle of the retelling of the first deliverance. We were slaves in Egypt. God delivered us from Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and so redeemed Israel from all oppression. So may he redeem us from all the tyrants who oppress us. The message of Passover is that a time of freedom and deliverance will come. Last year we were slaves. Next year, may all Israel be free. Now the ritual of opening the door for Elijah is not old. It does not go back beyond the 15th or 16th century. It seems to have grown not so much out of the messianic drama as from desperation. Europe knew the blood level charge. Many in the Christian world believed that on Passover night, Jews required the blood of a Christian infant in order to complete the ceremony. That libel against the Jewish tradition is, of course, part of the mythology of Christian anti-Semitism. It may come from a misunderstanding of the practices of Seder night, which has the leader, as each of the 10 plagues are recited, dip his finger in a cup of wine and flick a drop on the floor. The list of the 10 plagues begins with the plague dam, blood, the Hebrew word for blood. We do so because there is a text in the... Apparently, either someone watched this practice and misunderstood it, or an apostate who wanted to defame his birth people and thereby build up status among his new confreres passed around this calumny. Whatever its basis, the story was the cause of much killing over the centuries. In the ghettos of the Rhineland in the 15th century, custom developed of keeping the door of the home open on Seder night, so anyone who passed by might look in and see what the Seder ritual actually was, how innocuous it was. And actually, there was a place at the Seder table for Elijah long before the door was opened to him. The place is the one which we call the cup for Elijah. The custom goes back to Talmudic times, developed out of an old halakhic dispute among the sages. As you know, we drink 4 cups of wine on Seder night. We do so because there is a text in which the word redeem is repeated 4 different times in 4 different ways. Some rabbis believe that a different verse should be the basis of that custom, a verse in which the promise of redemption is repeated 5 times rather than 4. Of course, there was a solution to this monumental dispute. We drink, all of us, 4 cups of wine, and we keep the 5th on the table. But we say that anybody who wants to can come and take up the 5th cup, bless it, and drink of it. With this solution, everybody seems satisfied. How did Elijah become identified with this 5th cup of wine? There was an ancient tradition that all unresolved Talmudic disputes would be resolved in Messianic times by Elijah. This impasse was one of those disputes, and therefore it was natural that the cup be associated with Elijah. Elijah represents the will of God to redeem. He bespeaks the power of God to save. He is the herald of good tidings. He personifies all that is hopeful and messianic in our tradition. Over the years, liberal Judaism has tended to push such messianic legends aside. They are outside our experience. They seem to be the product of ancient credulity. But it is necessary to hope. The prophets of Israel describe Israel as the prisoners of hope. Hope derives from the dreams of our unconscious. It comes out of the overflowing heart and the outreaching spirit. How often have we come to a meeting in our community during a particularly dark passage caused by another outrage by the Russians or the Germans or the Iranians against our people, and felt encouraged when, at the end, someone said, "Am Yisrael Chai," the people of Israel still lives. We draw strength from the continuity of our tradition. We draw strength when someone reminds us that the guardian of Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. If we don't believe them, we still draw strength from the Elijah legends. Now, they are illogical, they are unphilosophic, but they are necessary. It matters not to us whether Elijah lived or died, or whether he's alive or not. What the matter is that he personifies the hope of our people, the messianic dream, and keeps that personification, that dream, in our minds. It does not matter that Elijah did not come Friday last. What matter is that we sustain the hope, that the doors of our heart remain open to the message of hope, the feeling that beyond and behind the confusions and the ominous headlines of the day, there lies a better day. It is for that reason I believe that our national anthem is called Hatikva, the hope.
One of the very strange elements of Shirley MacLaine's autobiography is this whole notion of the return of the soul in another life. And I've had many people ask me questions, does this really, is this an idea that Jews believe in? The answer is that throughout many centuries in our own history, the idea of the transmigration of a soul has been part and parcel of our own religion. The idea that the soul, to contradict the, I guess it's the Budweiser commercial, goes around more than once, is the idea that the soul can return in another body, both as an opportunity for the soul and as a punishment for the soul. According to the Jewish mystics, The individual soul can be recycled in another body up to a maximum of 3 times. At the end of the 3rd cycle, one soul had to return to the treasury of souls and could not come down any further into a body. Some souls would return in new bodies as an opportunity presented to that soul to complete work in another life that it had not accomplished in a previous life. For example, if someone had died young and hadn't finished their own course, their own destiny, they can come back in another body at another time in order to fulfill their own destiny. That is an opportunity. One can come back in order to complete mitzvot, commandments, which one didn't do correctly the first time around. And yet Judaism also teaches that transmigration can be ordered upon a soul as a form of punishment. Someone who lived poorly, who lived wrong in one life, can be sent back into another body, even into an animal body, in order to provide punishment for the wrong that one did in one life. This notion of the occult, which seems so foreign to all of us, and seems to be the kind of occult idea that we would not associate with Judaism, is indeed part and parcel of our own culture and our own religious tradition. In looking briefly at the early moments of the soul at conception and the final moments of the soul at death, I've tried to show briefly a little something about the concept of human destiny according to Jewish mystics. The soul is the link between a human being and God. Jewish mysticism develops this idea of the soul and accentuates the spiritual dimensions of human life by promoting teachings about the soul and about human destiny. According to these mystics and these occult thinkers within Judaism, the goal of Judaism itself is the reunification of the individual soul with God after life, in the next life, in the afterlife. And I've tried to just briefly show this morning that the mystic quest, which is so much a part today of our general culture and of Christian culture, charismatic culture, and even of the kind of occult doctrines that we find promoted and which we believe not to be a part of Judaism, in fact, have been and continue to be in many ways part of our tradition. It's always strange and unsettling to find out what is indeed a part of the Jewish tradition. But I think we may all agree that the mystic quest itself is a relatively unknown part of our tradition. But as we grow, as we mature, as we ask ourselves deep questions about the nature of human life and about our own destiny, I think we may find it possible to turn to the mystical tradition in Judaism to find answers to some of our most profound questions. Thank you.